shouldn't get to use that metaphor since I'm not the gardener. But the theme for the week is everyday spirituality, everyday theology. And the first two sessions that I did were much more on spirituality, and they came fairly directly out of a book that I did that was trying to rethink spirituality for people in the midst of chaos or daily life. And I would say the second two sessions are more recent work that I've been thinking about and doing. And they're more, it's more focused on everyday theology. And there's not a big distinction sometimes in my mind between spirituality and theology. But I thought it would be helpful to kind of flag that slight shift both in focus and in my own, what's the right word, where I am in my relationship to this material. So this is a little bit newer material for me, and it's something I'm thinking about now. I'm thinking a lot about bodies and knowledge, and then now theological knowledge, and how our bodies affect what we know. So, but are there any, there's some of you who have been to the other two sessions, and now this is your third. Is there anything lingering that, you know, it's hard for me not to want to go back and say, here's something I didn't get to say yesterday, and I know there's people who haven't been here, so I'm not going to do that. But is there anything lingering for people who just would want to make a comment before we kind of make a shift to today's stuff? Just want to know, sort of a check-in.
Yeah, I actually have a question. And at some point in time, if you would talk about what makes an everyday practice, what gives it spiritual potential, just at some point?
That's, I was going to ask actually the same question is, even if you're reading, what defines reading as a spiritual practice? Is it something that you could just say, oh, I'm doing this intentionally now, and this can be my spiritual practice for the day, versus, again, just mindlessly reading? Is there a, how do you get into that mindset, or what does that entail?
Oh, I've got to think about that. I don't know if I have an answer right off the top of my head. I do think it has something to do with attention, consciousness, intentional use of an activity with a greater purpose in mind.
That brings a question for me. I guess it's related to the same thing. Is what makes it spiritual? Yeah, I mean, because we even talked about reading erotic information. What makes that spiritual or not spiritual? I mean, for me, reading spirituality for me is when I'm actually reading a Christian book or even an Islamic book to challenge me and stuff. I didn't get the correlation between that and just reading anything.
One thing that occurred to me as we were talking last night, I was reminded of Brother Lawrence, and what is he, 14th century, 15th century?
But Middle Ages.
He teaches in a very simple way to simply think about God. And he's basically sitting in a monastery in the kitchen, peeling potatoes or peeling carrots, and he teaches, well, think about God initially once every hour, and then try and think about God once every 30 minutes, and then once every 15 minutes, and before long he is just constantly steeped in, immersed in this relationship with God, and it seems to me that you could apply that then in your everyday practices, even in your reading. That it's that simple.
That it is
your
that
consciousness.
Simple. I mean, why I say it's that simple is I was thinking, and you said it really well, that for me it has to do with two things, and I actually think they're centered around the great commandments. If it puts you into a sense of love of God and love of others. So if the practice lends itself to a sense of love of God and love of others, it can to me, that would be how I would understand its potential for being spiritually formative. I think that works. I mean, I think, and maybe that goes back to the discussion we had at the very end of our conversation on reading, where we were trying to start to discern what readings, when we were talking about tasting, I don't remember, ingesting, you know, the pleasure, morally, and, informative, spiritually transformative, and how do you judge literature? I think you have to have some centering narrative that allows you to say this narrative doesn't build up these values or convictions. Well, let's move ahead a bit, just a little bit more space work. So here's another question for I'd like to hear people to struggle with a bit. What is theology?
God talk.
God talk. That's you could break the word apart. Theo and ology, knowledge of God. God talk is a very helpful way. Others, yeah.
The one that sticks with me is faith seeking understanding.
Faith seeking understanding.
Who said that? Somebody thinks?
That is, I'm not sure who gets attributed with that. It's used a lot. It's like it's in the Catholic.
Reformed people really love it. I'm thinking it might be obviously.
I thought it was
Anselm.
I also feel like there's a liberation theology twist on it, but I can't remember what it is, of faith seeking action or enactment. But
could you repeat what you said?
Faith seeking understanding is a really ancient and common way of describing theology. Any other efforts to define it or to say what it is?
To me, it's always the study of God.
Mm-hmm. Study of God. All right, so here's...
You can carry it out to acting out, too, but the word itself with that other words around it, to me, is study of.
Well, here's another question. Who does theology?
Who what?
Who does theology?
Every sentient being.
Hopefully we all do.
Any other opinions on that?
Theology feels much more academic to me than saying we all do it because they all exist.
Yeah.
The intentionality behind thinking and processing is important for the definition for me.
Anybody else have that feel of theology feeling kind of academic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's for experts only.
Mm-hmm. Experts do it.
We often think that preachers are the only one that do it. I mean, that's not a lot of people that aren't highly involved would say it's only preachers that do it.
Not all preachers do it.
It's a funny word, theology is, because it is this name of this discipline, the study of God, or however you define it, but it's also a way to describe your worldview and your way of understanding God, you know. You say, my theology is, or that doesn't fit my theology. I mean, in that sense, that's maybe the sense in which we're all theologizers, because we all have, you know, this certain worldview, but...
Really, these are all really helpful comments, because I think we got just in the range of what people said, some of the tensions that surround what theology is and who does it. And just one of my aims, and it was already apparent in the earlier sort of focus on everyday spirituality and the shift to everyday theology that I'm doing in the last two sessions, that I have deep convictions about a non-elitist reclamation of theology as every sentient being's responsibility and right, or what's the right word, ability, capacity. And sort of a desire to return, just as I had kind of a desire to return spirituality to people in all walks of life, the same sense of wanting to return theology to the body of the church. And sometimes it's hard to do that because in the last 3 centuries at least, it has, and maybe more, even going back to early sort of medieval era and Aquinas in the Catholic Church, it has become progressively more isolated to universities, monasteries are connected to universities, and then universities and seminaries, and then it might get close to the congregation through the preacher. And so I sort of have a second aim besides this idea of sort of returning theology to the people, and that is to think about how theology is not just formed conceptually, that it isn't just a cognitive or doctrinal practice, but it's actually as formed by what we do in everyday routine, including what we do with our bodies. I can sort of say that again. So theology is not just conceptual or based on what we believe and proclaim, but it's also what we do. And I thought it would be interesting to share, before kind of moving to the body stuff, I'm not the only person kind of interested in this idea right now. And I thought it'd be fun to share some research from 3 different scholars. And let me just start with the systematic theologian and then go to the sociologist of religion. And they're just doing some interesting things in studying what people say they believe and what they do. Robert Schreider is a Catholic theologian who's been really interested in thinking about local theologies. And the reason why I thought it would be helpful to just mention him is that he does some of the work that we just did in, you know, hearing what is theology and who does it. He describes 4 different types of theologies. And even doing that is helpful to say, theology isn't just one thing. It's located in a variety of places. And the one that's most familiar, I think, often to many of us, is what he describes as theology as sure knowledge, this sort of academic, elite practice of intellectual reflection on doctrine. And that has really been a reigning understanding for the last couple of centuries, particularly in the 20th century. But then he names 3 other kinds, one of which is much more ancient. And I think what's interesting is when I describe these other 3 kinds, we just don't use theology in this way as much, but they are within the tradition. And so they sound a little bit foreign to us. The first one he names is theology as sacred text. And here he means traditions, not just Christianity, but certainly you can see this in Judaism and Islam, where one gains theological credentials by memorizing commentaries on scripture, or by doing commentaries on scripture. So Luther wrote commentaries on a number of biblical texts, so did Calvin, and all the way up to Karl Barth, you have people, writing the epistle to the Romans, you know, commentary on that by Karl Barth. It's not very typical today. A second, besides sure knowledge, so sacred text, he talked about 2 others. Theology, this is his word, as wisdom. And what he means by that is spiritual devotion to God, a path to God, a little bit more theology as spirituality. That would be my rewording. And finally, his 4th category is theology as practice, which is maybe a little closer to what I'm trying to get at, of this sort of integration between what we do and what we say as displaying or embodying our theology. So that's what a systematic theologian does. Let me tell you what Robert Wuthnow does. He has a really wonderful book called Growing Up Religious. And I'm, you know, this was, I can think about putting these books on my back page. And they just kind of came to mind as I thought about this session. He basically has some wonderful quotes. He's a sociologist who has interviewed with a team of colleagues, 200 people, really trying to get them to talk about how they are, you know, what formed them as religious. And what he finds out is that, just here's a number of things he finds out. Having the Bible read to you growing up was less important than seeing your parents read it. The act of praying is more important than the content. People remember the short, simple, repeated prayers more than they do teaching about prayer or anything more elaborate. People are really affected, and maybe this gets me to body and knowledge, by artifacts that are around their house and in their congregations. Bibles, jewelry, statues, candles, stained glass windows, clothes and routine. His book is packed with stories of the impact of clothes and routines in preparation to go to worship. And here's the one that's really, I think, interesting. Ritual meals. Meals with family, meals with congregation, and all that surrounds them. Bible reading and table grace are more important than Sunday school. Again, partly because they're repeated ritual routines. And if people go to Sunday school, being there was more memorable than anything that was taught. And all this is, you know, not to negate the importance of catechism or teaching or content, but it is to remind us how much material culture impacts our beliefs. One of the quotes from his book, children absorb a lot simply by, quote, staring at the altar, the paintings, and the stained glass window week after week. I have a story I have told about this for myself. Growing up in a congregation at the front of the sanctuary, instead of the maybe more typical stained glass, for whatever reason, my home denomination of Bloomington, Indiana, had chosen a, now I've got a blank for it, the living tree, but that's not the word. The tree of life, thank you. The tree of life. Quite symbolically done, you know, with a lot of symbolism in the top. I don't want to describe it in too much detail, but it's difficult. Star, moon, bread and loaf. I never thought that that was having any impact on my theology until years later, as a young adult. I wondered, I was at a denominational biannual meeting in a city in Iowa, and wandered into worship in a congregation that was built almost identically to my home church. Same Gothic white stone structure, same wood pews. Walked in, and one really amazing difference was the stained glass at the front was completely a different picture, much more Christocentric. I don't remember details except that it so struck me that I had been formed, and probably in a tradition that has a fairly low Christology, a low sense of Christ's place in the Christian story. But I think I was formed in a less Christocentric way than I might have been if week after week after week what I looked at had been different. Finally, the third person, Mark Chavez, who's also a sociology of religion, really became interested in what he called congruence, religious congruence. And he studied and then makes an argument that it's not so much what you believe that matters, it's what you do. And the correlation sometimes between what you believe and what you do is minimal. So there's a lot more religious incongruence than. So for example, maybe another way to say it is, religious people do not act in more pro-social ways than anyone else. They just think they do. Yeah, it's a little startling. I think he's actually not saying that it's not important to be in a religious community, informed by a religious community, but he is saying that if you want to predict someone's behavior, you're better off knowing where they are than who they are, because they're so impacted by their situation. The religious situation is more important, he argues, than the religious disposition. So religious ideas, we think, are, you know, logically connected, integrated, internally consistent, but he's arguing that they're a lot less consistent and integrated and consistent over across situations than we think they are. All this is a little challenging to systematic theologians who think, you know, if you just get all the logical doctrines figured out, and then if you just teach them to laity, children and adults, your job is over. I think all these studies kind of make you think twice about what forms our faith and how does our how is our theology sustained.
What was the name of that last person?
The last one was, actually, I can give you that citation. It's just an article, and it's Mark Chavez, C-H-A-V-E-S. The article is called, and it tells you, it's really a nice title, Rain Dances in the Dry Season, Overcoming the Religious Congruence Fallacy. Why does he have rain dances in dry season? Well, he's basically saying you never do a rain dance in the dry season. That's why you get rain. That's why you get rain. You do it when it's the rainy season, so your convictions fit the reality. Maybe a little complication to explain the title, but he's just challenging the sense that we are consistent with that we do what we say, that we have to think hard about our making our convictions cohere with our practices. Well, okay, let's go to the body. Enough on theology and how some other people have thought about the material, how materiality shapes what we believe. I'm going to just read to you a little bit to get you thinking about how bodies shape our knowledge of God or our theological convictions about God. And what I want to do is just give you some of my own experiences and some reflections on those. On the handout, it's really like 1, 2, and 3. And I'm going to stop there and see if you still want to hear more. Number 4 is another really interesting study about children and their formation that she did for First Communion. And it also reflects how children are formed through their senses more than we realize. And we probably, I think you'll see where I say in number 5, we're not so different. Theology often resides in our body memories. But at one point, you know, either between 3 and 4 or between 4 and 5, I'd like to stop just to prepare you and have you think about a body memory where you were formed in your own religious practice. So, arriving at the Abbey Church a little early, Abbey Church in St. John University's campus, the Benedictine Order in Collegeville, Minnesota. So arriving at the Abbey Church a little early, I watch as the monks enter and bow towards the altar, where a wooden cross is suspended from the vaulted ceiling, towards God, I suppose. God's presence does seem palpable in the stained glass light and quiet. I don't know what's involved in bowing or what it means for each monk, but I seldom feel so low church Protestant as when I don't bow before turning into the wooden pew to lower my seat and find the right page for morning prayer. I would feel awkward and insincere bowing. It is not a practice I have learned. It is not bodily familiar to me. I have even incorporated that word itself, you know, taken into my body, core, incorporated. Into my body, my corporeal repertoire, a modern bias, or maybe it's a certain Calvinist reform, that's the legacy to my Christian Church Disciple of Christ tradition, but a bias against actions like bowing. But I also feel slightly irreverent and careless not bowing, almost as if I slight God and miss a chance to mark my reverence and movement. I have gained new respect for bowing, and I am curious. What does it mean to bow to God and to each other as a repeated, lifelong body practice for these Benedictine monks? This question has preoccupied me because of other worship experiences lately, and my wider interest in theology and knowing and embodied knowing. A few years ago, I quit attending the Christian Church congregation where my membership resides. Sporadically, I attend other disciple churches in Nashville, but more regularly, I worship in an Episcopalian congregation. And I'm struck by body habits and postures different from those so familiar to me after a half century of faith, yeah, I'm 57, after a half century of faith formation among disciples. My bodily sense of disconnect is especially acute during Eucharist, or what disciples call communion, or the Lord's Supper. What does it mean to process forward and hold out your hands to receive the Eucharist from a priest versus sitting and passing a communion plate, taking bread, and then serving your neighbor? I'm sure I'm not the first to ask this. I only note it as another powerful experience in which I have felt the body and knowing theology and God come into keen play. Even if I wanted to make the Episcopalian congregation my home, compelled by its liturgy, its music, preaching, and mission, my body resists, especially at communion, or in this case, Eucharist. I'm not sure I will ever be overcome entirely a sense that it's not quite right to process forward and exemplify in my body a theology with which I don't entirely agree, that one goes to the altar to receive one by one, hands outstretched, Christ's bread and blood from a priestly mediator of God's grace. Occasionally, disciples process forward for communion. Free church worship allows variety here, but when we do, the minister, this is really interesting if you ever wander into a free church worship, the minister or congregation just hold out the bread and we tear off a piece. No one places it in our hands even in that case. So that's be fairly typical, I think. Even this tiny difference in body action is, I think, full of meaning. As with bowing, I learn from and I appreciate the Episcopalian practice all the more. I see meaning in cupping your hands before another. This body posture overflows with potential. With your hands waiting to receive, you could be begging, pleading, hopeful, expectant, dependent, or grateful, each gesture loaded with a host of theological connotations. On more occasions than I anticipate, I am moved when the priest or those assisting raise the bread or wine, look me in the eyes, and tell me, the body of Christ, the bread of heaven, the blood of Christ, the cup of salvation. It's interesting, I think I've now participated in this congregation long enough that when I was here on Sunday, I really missed those words, the bread, because the pattern here, and maybe it varies from each congregation, was just the body of Christ. And I was like, aren't you going to tell me it's the bread of heaven? Because I just had heard the words enough to miss them. The blood of Christ, I was waiting, the cup of salvation. I know I have been given a serious gift and a startling blessing, a physical taste of the intangible. Sometimes I look sideways at the circle of random adults and children around me at the front of the sanctuary, standing waiting with empty palms awkwardly turned up as the priest and those assisting start this round of distribution. I see with a little embarrassment what a strange pose we have all struck. Rarely do people display their neediness or desire to be filled so overtly and patiently. I make space in my pew one Sunday morning for a woman who tells me after the service how the congregation has become a good place for for she and her husband, a lapsed Catholic, and herself a Lutheran. I tell her how much I have been drawn myself finding the church a home for worship, but caught and constrained somehow during Eucharist as someone raised, also raised in another tradition. She says right away that she understands. When my Lutheran mother visited, I had to prepare her. A little surprised, I asked, what was so different? In my narrow mind, I thought Lutherans were really liturgically so similar to Episcopalians. After all, they have both traditions go forward to receive Eucharist. How could this be so disorienting? So I asked. We never drink from a common cup in my home congregation, she responds. We use individual cups. That this difference seems so disruptive to her, and yet so slight to me, reminded me again that I wasn't alone in finding my faith embedded in the smallest of movements, with their multiple, highly elusive, seemingly negligible meanings. Christian faith, I think, and this is my argument for this session, becomes deeply entangled right here in these minute body actions, and maybe less in these big conceptual frameworks laboriously worked out over centuries by church leaders, academic scholars, and Christian denominations. We say more, at least, than we know or understand through our bodies. And I think this is a surprise, should be, to theological educators who put such stock in our words and ideas. Now, this doesn't negate the value of systematic doctrinal reflection. But I'm saying the devil, this is to play with words, is in, or the divine, is in the corporeal details. Let me just, this, I'm going to read one paragraph and then stop and see what you're all thinking. So I'm saying our bodies know, our bodies remember, our bodies learn ways to embrace and be embraced by God. Bowing and eating are a small part of a whole constellation of habitual actions that make up our lives of faith. And here are some interesting questions to ask. Are some postures better than others? What do we confess in our small body motions? Do we lose something when we lose certain body postures in a tradition? How do we prevent ritual movements from becoming petty, trivial, or meaningless? When I join these monks for morning and evening prayer, I really wonder about bowing, a body movement that disciples don't practice. Monks and other Roman Catholics bow to God when they enter, and they also do so when they praise the Trinity during worship and when they leave. For the daily offices on Sunday, the monks procession together, they bow to each other before returning to their seats. What does it mean over a lifetime to bow each time they glorify God? And what about bowing to each other? I notice some monks make eye contact and others do not. Does that matter? Some of the older monks are stooped. Is it from bowing? So let me ask you, think for a second. Think for a second, if I can find my notes, for the question I want you to ask yourselves. Of body memories, think of one body memory that my own reflections sparked. And then I want you to turn to your neighbor and just talk about it for a second. Yeah, all right. Thoughts?
Well, we were both just discussing, for us, the ritual doesn't mean anything, or one way or the other. It's what God's act is.
It say again, it's what?
What God's doing, what God's act is. That both of us felt that same way.
So what you do doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It's what God does.
Well, it's the ritual.
It doesn't form you or have an impact on you.
I wouldn't say that, but I'm saying that when I look at ritual as you described it, I look at that and say, what was the origin of that? And I go back and say, well, it probably was, this is what the early you know, this is what Jesus asked them to do? Did he show them to do this? Or was this something that was assimilated from other reasons? It came in from the cultures they were in. So it really has nothing to do with, you know, what Jesus asked us to do. It's something that we brought into it because of other enculturations. So, I mean, that's a very Puritanistic point of view, I would imagine. But I wonder. I look at it and I wonder.
It's hard to practice your faith outside of reality. You always have things brought in. It's always, you're practicing within the material world.
Yes, but do you know it is the brought in? Or is that true?
Did other people push back maybe a little against this and say, I partly agree with what you're saying, did other people say there were things that did form me?
Oh, definitely for me, yes. And I would say, for me, I grew up in a church, and it was a Lutheran church, so it was unusual that we had kneeling benches in our church. Mm-hmm. So during the prayer time,
kneeling benches.
So we always kneel during the prayer time. Mm-hmm. And it has always been difficult for me as an adult to go to churches where you do not have that. Mm-hmm. Because that's just a part of making the prayers of the church more worshipful for me. And it's been difficult.
What is theologically, if we did adopt, let's say if we adopt bowing from
the Muslims, for instance, seven times a day.
It could be, or it could be from a sense of
the monk.
Well, what I guess I'm getting at is, what are we saying theologically by bowing or kneeling? Maybe to stay with kneeling. What's going on?
I think what's missing, because she doesn't get it from her husband, is humility.
That's the first word that I thought of, yes. Too. Humble.
Yeah, there's this just, you know, what is the word? We're pretty, well, the in curvatus se was the only a Latin term. We're turned in on ourselves. And these actions unfold that turning in to ourselves, looking at ourselves all the time, out to something else.
Yeah. Rachel.
Well, I think bowing to me has a sign of honor and reverence for God or for the holy, different than, like you say, I think for me kneeling is it's a sense of humility and putting yourself in a different position to God. But and bowing has a bit of that, and I think some forms of bowing really do have the humility aspect, but I think bowing as you enter a church seems to me more of the reverence, or bowing to one another is more of the reverence for the holy.
Oh, I was just going to say, I can't remember what year I read it, or what year it occurred, the Japanese shogunate oppressed Christianity in the islands, not by anything one said, but the Christians of Japan had to renounce Christianity or die. They were crucified in the surf. That's when the water came up, it drowned them in the crosses for those who didn't do this. But all they had to do was step on the icon of Jesus. They didn't have to say anything. And that just, what struck me about that was how wordy we are in our understanding, in our theology, our logi, you know, and how words are, we kill over words, and they would kill over the action. And it just like, I thought, I could step on the icon to save my neck, yeah, it's no problem, the icons don't mean anything to me. And I thought, no, that was it. You either were, you know, Jesus was God or Jesus wasn't God, depending on whether you put your foot on that icon. And I've just kind of loosened up on words, because they don't carry the freight any more than the icon does in one sense, but nothing carries the freight. What can carry the freight of the majesty of God? Yeah, so, but what struck me was how bodily that was in a culture that we're bowing to each other and to the authority in the culture was so important.
We do debate words. I think we also have, some people would say we have equal conflict and maybe are more disturbed by body actions and have trouble accommodating diverse. I was actually going to ask, are there, how many people come from a kneeling tradition and have kneeled as a practice? Who's kneeled as a practice?
In terms of which?
Just kneeling to pray.
In church.
In church or otherwise. How many have never knelt?
We knelt for communion for years and years and years, but we don't do that anymore. But not to pray.
Who's never knelt ever in worship? I mean, I would have to put myself in that group.
Depends if you count communion or not, I guess.
Yeah, so that makes it probably a little broader. I do think there's something really formative about kneeling or not kneeling. And there were obviously theological reasons why certain traditions chose to eliminate that from their practice. And partly what I think I'm saying is it's not a negligible decision. It's pretty powerful in how it may shape faith. And
it was even controversial in my church when we put the kneeling.
That was a controversy.
Oh.
That's probably what I was saying. Sometimes we have bigger controversies over communion cups or the kneeling than we do over conceptual doctrinal. And I think we have controversies over both. But.
And I never thought of this because we were only talking about church, but as a child, we knelt every night at our bed to say our prayers. And still now, if I'm really troubled, that's what I want to do, is kneel.
I think all I'm really saying is it matters, just to think about it and to think about what it is conveying to yourself physically, it matters.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to just do what you feel like doing with your body too. Part of my adolescent experience was as a Jesus person and this expansive openness of your hands is such a non-Lutheran thing to do. And yet, it felt okay oftentimes. And I'm in my soul a much higher church person than the church I attend. And yet, you can't just do that. You can't just rock back and forth when you say a psalm, for instance. You can't do that. It's not done. So there are many little things that work. I'm not sure if it's because I'm partly what's the Asperger's spectrum or something. I don't know what it is. But you know what I'm saying. I mean, that's
autistic
spectrum, something.
It gives some kind of focus. Yeah. I do think partly what you heard in some of my words that I also want to convey. You're helping me remember when you think about some of the more evangelical worship styles, is a deep respect for the motions and positions that traditions embrace, even if you differ, or even if you might personally object, to see their potential to be spiritually formative and important. I mean, certainly for me, participating in both the Roman Catholic worship of morning and evening prayer and the Episcopalian worship has done that, even though I really probably won't ever join this Episcopal. Maybe I will someday, but I think there's something, as I've described it as best I can, that will probably prevent me from doing so. And maybe to say a little more on the communion, if maybe many of you haven't had the sort of free church experience of passing communion plates, but there is something, my tradition is also a weekly communion, and Presbyterians and Methodists often aren't, for example. So I'm really formed by passing, and there's something really powerful about sharing communion as a congregation and taking in unison. There's something being said by that bodily embracing of the Lord's Supper that's different and I think valuable in itself. I could tell that Rachel had
I have lots. I've done a lot of ritual studies around communion too, so it's been really important for me to visit lots of churches. So I've had lots of different experiences from my childhood. And, I haven't appreciated drinking together until I've tried it other ways, because when I was younger, it was the thimbles and the passing of the plates and silence. And then I went, the first time I went to a congregation where you walked forward, we stood in a circle and passed to each other in the circle in the front of the congregation.
And it was very disorienting at first, but it became very powerful for me to sing joyful songs while passing communion to one another and looking at the person and saying by name to the person, this is the body of Christ broken for you, this is the bread of life given for you, whatever, something like that. So that to me was very disorienting but became powerful. But it was also the tone, the silence and solemnness from my childhood changed to like joyful songs during communion.
Yeah.
And then I also have a really strong memory of the first time I was in California and somebody did the Remember Your Baptism by sprinkling us all with water really exuberantly with rosemary sprigs. And it was super sensory, you know, to have rosemary scented water being thrown at me and really joyfully and exuberantly. And I was like, at first, totally shocked and totally surprised that they were doing this because that had not been a part of my tradition at all. And now that's another tradition that I really love and really value that experience. So there's a couple, yeah, and then standing for worship in an Orthodox church for an entire service has been one of the most difficult but also very powerful experiences that I've had.
Yeah. Yes.
I'd like to share some things. I mean, I've been raised in a church, period. Literally. I mean, I was baptized and I'm still a member. The church has changed because it was a small organization that became quite large, and now is much smaller. But more than that, it was a very conservative Lutheran church that started. I mean, the collar, the whole bit, I mean, very strict. And I can remember it was not very pleasant being there because of that very strict structure. They moved into a new building, ultra modern, and I mean, it went from the closing of the altar for communion to there's no chance of closing the altar. The railing is there, but you can't close it. It's always open. Everything changed. My experience with communion was having to go through confirmation. I was like 13, 2 years of study. Then you had a chance to go and partake. The same church. I'm not sure what the lowest age is. I mean, literally anyone.
Babies.
Yeah, babies can be given. That is hugely different. And then I had the experience of being in Greece for 5 weeks. And we participated in a few Greek Orthodox. The one thing that struck me about the Greek Orthodox, breaking of the bread, number one, the congregation brings their own loaf. Two, it's not a small loaf. They're like this. I mean, they're big. And they stack them on a table. There's not just one, there's probably 30 of them up there.
Oh my goodness.
Right. And when they break the bread, they share one loaf. That one is consumed before anyone leaves. Whether it's after the service or before they leave, that bread is consumed. But the rest of them are all blessed and they go home.
Yeah.
And that's just, talk about symbolism and meaning. That has meaning to me. I guess what I'm looking at symbolism, I'm looking at the liveliness of it versus the stoic.
The one thing that I think is so clear and I want to sort of leave people with is we've tended to negate the power of our material surrounding, and these things matter. So whether you're a lay person who's active on the worship committee or you're going or already are a worship leader, you know, what you do physically with water, food, body posture, really does say a lot to your adults and children. And the one story I didn't get to tell is children in their first communion. They develop more than anything a theology of taste and a theology of movement. They feel members of the church by what the bread tastes, their eagerness to taste the bread, their reaction to how it tastes, and their attention to movement. They want to do what they see adults doing. And some of the rest of the
doctrinal knowledge that is hoped to be conveyed is not what children are conveying, or they're putting it together with their sensory experience. And it's a pretty fascinating study that Susan Wrigley Bales does. I need to let you go. So bodies matter. We'll see you tomorrow. If you could come back. And I leave